So let us get on with it. I want to start by saying something that isn't directly necessarily about the story in the Exodus, that it's more about the way we remember the story in Passover. Because when we remember the story of the Exodus and Passover, surprisingly enough, a big part of the text is dedicated to explaining to us not how wonderful and great the Exodus itself, the moment of coming out of Egypt, was, even though, of course, there is a lot of emphasis on that, but rather how much greater and more important and more wholesome and more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the moment of coming out of the sea was, the moment of crossing the Red Sea and then seeing it close on the Egyptians and drown them. Here, let's look at it together in the Haggadah. Moment. Here it is. Rabbi Yosei Haglili says, from where can you derive that the Egyptians were struck with 10 plagues in Egypt and struck with 50 plagues at the sea? In Egypt, what does it state? Then the magicians said unto Paro, this is the finger of God. And at the sea, what does it state? And Israel saw the Lord's great hand that he used upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord. They believed in the Lord and in Moshe, his servant. And from that, it takes that if there are 10 plagues in Egypt, it must be multiplied by 5, as in a finger to a hand is a fifth. So the 10 plagues must be the fifth of however many plagues or plague-like impact God pressed onto the Egyptians on the sea. And then they go from it and keep adding. They say, oh, no. Actually, there are 50 plagues in Egypt. And they find a way to explain it. Oh, and in that case, there are 250 plagues in the sea. And so on and on and on. They keep emphasizing over and over in a somewhat fanciful game of math and history combined, excuse me, that the sea was the really big deal. Today we're going to talk about that big deal. Today we're going to visit that moment. Last week we went out of Egypt, so to speak, with the Israelites. And today we will walk with them as they reach the sea, as the Egyptians chase behind them, as they find themselves stuck between these two disasters, drowning and being taken over by a vengeful Egyptian army. And as they, we'll talk details later, cross the sea after God opens it for them, reach to the other side safely, watch it close over their enemies, and give a song of praise. But before we go into it, I want to just pose the question, why are the sages portraying this section of the story and not the section we learned about last week, not the section of the actual Exodus of leaving Egypt behind? Why are they portraying this moment, the sea moment, as the bigger deal? After all, the book, I mean, obviously the names in Latin are a little bit not part of our tradition, but still the book is called Exodus. When we talk about it, even in Pesach, we talk about Yetziat Mitzrayim, coming out of Egypt. So why is it that it's the ocean that we remember as more grand? By the way, it's not only the sages in the Haggadah that treat it as somehow more important or more central or something like that. There's also other things that position it as a moment of even greater significance, in a sense, in the actual leaving of Egypt. For example, the very fact that the Jews, the Israelites, give thanks. When they went out of Egypt, there's no song. There's no praising the Lord. There's no dancing. There's no rejoicing. They're just walking for a week. That's all we know. Whereas when they leave, when they look back and see the sea closing on the Egyptians, they start singing. I'm here in the same box, box number one. Thus the Lord delivered Israel that day from the Egyptians. Israel saw the Egyptians. He's dead. Israel saw the wondrous power which the Lord had wielded against the Egyptians. The people feared the Lord. They had faith in the Lord and his servant Moses. None of that was told to us when we left Egypt. The idea of having fear and faith in God and Moses, None of it was mentioned before. And then they go on and express it in this beautiful way. Then Moses said, and the Israelites sang a song to the Lord. They said, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. Horse and driver, he has hurled into the sea. Not only are the sages glorifying this moment, not only are the Jews themselves, the Israelites themselves, appear more attuned to its grandeur than they are to the moment of coming out of Egypt, but also in the history of the world, in the way that the imagery of the Exodus transcended the event as a Jewish event and became a symbol for liberation movements throughout history, also there, the imagery that stuck perhaps most regularly or most prominently is the image of the open sea and then the closing sea. I want to give two examples from American history, but there are many others. One is, I hope you can see it, it's this beautiful image. Some of you might be familiar with it. This, when the American colonies, the British colonies in America, declared their independence, they wanted to come up with a seal of the Union that people could rally around. Now, this was not the seal that was accepted eventually. This was, in fact, Benjamin Franklin's suggestion of what he thought would be the best image that the American colonies in their fight against Britain. This is during the war. This is at the moment of the Declaration of Independence itself. The image that came to his mind was the image of watching a tyrant drown. And he created this imagery of the parting of the sea, of the Egyptians drowning while the Jews are looking from the shore, accompanied by the words, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. Another example is this famous speech, excuse me for a second, by Martin. Can you see the speech here?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. A famous speech by Martin Luther King, The Death of Evil Upon the Seashore. He gave this speech in 1959, and he was talking about the Supreme Court of America's decision of Brown versus Board of Education. And he likened it to the closing of the Red Sea on tyranny the point of his imagery, the point of his comparison was in saying that there's this moment when you see the end of what subjugated you. You see it with your own eyes. I will read it. It's worthy of reading. Many years ago, the Negro was thrown into the Egypt of segregation. For years, it looked like he would never get out of this Egypt. The closed Red Sea always stood before him with discouraging dimensions. There are always those powers with hardened hearts who, despite the cries of many a Moses, refused to let the people go. But one day, through a world-shaking decree by the nine justices of the Supreme Court of America and an awakened moral conscience of many white persons of goodwill, backed up by the providence of God, the Red Sea was opened and the forces of justice marched through to the other side. As we look back, we see segregation caught in the rushing waters of historical necessity. Evil in the form of injustice and exploitation cannot survive. There is a Red Sea in history that ultimately comes to carry the forces of goodness to victory. And that same Red Sea closes in to bring doom and destruction to the forces of evil. Over and over again, we see that the Red Sea features prominently in people's minds in a way that is perhaps outsized when we think about the fact that Leila Seder was the moment of our going out, not the Red Sea. Not the opening of the Red Sea. That's Shvi'i Shel Pesach, the seventh day of Pesach. And the question we will try and answer together today as we read through this text and analyze it is a simple question, really, and yet a deep one. And that is why? What is so special about the parting of the Red Sea? Why was that a necessary part of the process? In terms of our course that focuses on freedom and liberation, why can't we talk about the liberation of the Jews from Egypt without talking about the Red Sea? Some answers are easy enough to see. Some answers just come naturally. Namely, that it's a much more visually clear symbol. Going out of Egypt must have been a very messy process. Groups upon groups upon groups of people marching. When do you count it as you're out of Egypt? the moment that you left home, the moment that the last Jew left the gate of the city, they're still in Egyptian territory. How do you define it? Excuse me? How do you define it?
I'm listening to something. What?
Sorry? Okay, I'm sorry. I think that there's some echo here, so if people could just mind their muting. Thank you. It's just a mess. It's a messy moment in history. You can't really pinpoint it. Whereas that moment when the washer gushes in satisfactorily, creating a barrier between the Israelites and the people chasing them, by killing the people chasing them, but in a sense, closing the door on the Egyptian chapter in their life, is a much more visually satisfying and visually accessible symbol that's easier to notice, easier to give thanks for, and easier for everybody, not just Moses and Aaron, who are in God's confidence and receive his interpretation, to notice for the liberation that it is. And this is an important point. We forget sometimes, I think, that most Jews, most Israelites, didn't have access to the fullness of God's plan. They would get whatever it was that Moshe and Aaron deigned to share with them. Some of them probably didn't even get as much as that. They were a big group. Some of them were in the fields when Moses and Aaron talked. Some of it was rumors. Some of them probably heard it from rumors that somebody heard Moshe say this. And then you know how rumors go and explode and implode and create variations that nobody expected on what the truth is. So when suddenly they're called upon to leave Egypt, even though they already had to tie the lambs to their door and kill the gods of Egypt, as we described last week, for many of them, it probably was a surprise, a moment of confusion, a moment of disbelief. In fact, there's a lot of hints for that in the text itself. Let's look at it together. And I will start. Just a moment. I will start with, sorry, just technical difficulty here. I will start with box number 2. And this is a quote from Exodus 12:39. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough that they had taken out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, since they had been driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. As somebody pointed out last week, God tells them that they will eat unleavened bread in memory of this day before it even happens. But here we see the other meaning of the unleavened bread. The other meaning is that even though Moses told them, tonight God will deliver you, they did not prepare. It's clear that that's not true of everybody, because later when they sing the song, Miriam and the women whip out drums and start dancing with drums. And Rashi famously says, they had foresight. They had said, surely God is going to do amazing miracles and salvations, and we should bring something to be able to sing songs of praise. So we have these two narratives or these two undercurrents of being prepared and unprepared. And if you think that the people are one group that knows one thing, then it's very confusing. But if you try and encompass in your mind, if you try to take a step back and encompass in your mind what it actually means for thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people in the era before Twitter and WhatsApp to do something as a group, it makes sense that some people are prepared, some people are not prepared, some people are certain, some people are uncertain. Some people are carrying drums and some people are carrying unleavened bread, and they're all there in that mess of coming out. And they don't know yet where things are going to go. There's this beautiful quote here, Margaret Atwood, when she describes stories, when she talks about stories. I'm jumping ahead to box number 3. Says something very interesting about the middle of a story. She talks here about how when we begin a story, we just have the promise, the beginning, the contract of what it implies will happen. Then we end the story, we can look back and see what everything meant. But in the middle, we still don't know. There's a sense of confusion, of undeterminacy. She puts it very well here. When you are in the middle of a story, it isn't a story at all, but a confusion, a dark roaring, a blindness, a wreckage of shattered glass and splintered wood, like a house in a whirlwind. It's only afterward that it becomes anything like a story at all, when you are telling it to yourself or to someone else. So in that moment, when the Jews, I'm sorry, I keep saying Jews, I mean Israelites, I'm just going to use them interchangeably to make things simpler for myself. When the Jews are coming out of Egypt and they have the drums and the unleavened bread, and some people are still behind because it's a long group of people and they're still under technically Paro's rule because they're still in his territory, they're still in the middle. And in that moment, they do not have, they simply do not have the perspective to understand the enormity of what's happening. And then comes the opening and the closing of the Red Sea and gives them the ability to look back and say, ah, this week, this whole last week, that was us coming out of Egypt. And then is it any wonder that it is them that they sing? Because to sing of something, to turn it into narrative, you need to feel that it is coherent. I want to liken it a little bit to the experience we are experiencing right now. We are watching horrible events unfold in the world. And I think that all of us, even if our hunches as to what's exactly happening and what's the importance of it, I assume all of us do have these hunches. We have these feelings of this is about freedom. This is about nationalism. This is about empire building. We all feel the dread, the feeling of dread and heaviness that comes from living through a horrible moment in history of death and destruction and instability and chaos. But we don't know yet what the story is. We don't know yet if our hunches will actually bear out. Even the political analysts and all their chattering glory and expertise and expensive degrees at their bags, even they can't really tell. They can say how it compares to the back. I've heard quite a few lectures in the last few days of people explaining things about the collapse of the Soviet Union, about the Cossack Wars, about all kinds of things, because we're looking for something to make sense of it. So we go to the past because we don't know what the future is. But it'll take time until we have the kind of perspective that will allow us to look back and say, oh, this was the turning point that really drained Russia from its national standing, or this was the beginning of a new world war, or this was the beginning of a new world order. We can't say it yet. And the Jews, as they are running from Paro in the desert for the first week, they don't have that yet either. The parting of the Red Sea and the closing of the Red Sea with its clear visual, with its accessible view that everybody sees at the same time, not just the elites talking to Moshe and Aaron or whoever randomly happened to be near them at the time. That moment is so clear that it suddenly puts everything that happened before that in perspective. So this is my first answer to the question why the rabbis glorify the parting of the Red Sea as so pivotal, as more pivotal than coming out. It's not because it's more than the coming out. It's because it completes it and gives the people the ability to see it for what it is, to acknowledge it for what it is. Excuse me for a moment. But now I want to start on a different answer that digs one layer deeper, because it's not just that the narrative structure of the Exodus is underdetermined or ambivalent at this point. It's also that the people themselves are ambivalent at this point until the parting of the Red Sea. The people themselves, despite the fact that they had to kill the gods of Egypt by slaughtering the lambs and put the blood over their doors, they're not clear yet on what they want and where it's going to go. Somebody asked last week about the borrowing of the money. There's a very odd section, right, that they're told, God instructs them, borrow money, borrow gold and dishes and household ware and clothes from your Egyptian neighbors. And they do, except it's pretty clear to us that there's no way they're going to return any of that. This is borrowing by name only. And the rabbis are very uncomfortable with it. Some of them say the Egyptians deserve it. The least they could give after decades and decades of unpaid labor is such trinkets. Others say that there was something more subtle, some sort of design involved, that God wants to teach the Israelites the lesson of standing up for yourself, of saying, I want something from you. As opposed to being the meek slaves that are grateful for whatever scraps are offered. But one way or another, I don't think it's only the Egyptians that are cheated here. I suspect that many of the Jews are cheated here also. Many of the Jews are like, oh, so we're taking some things and we'll bring them back. So I guess we're not going forever. I guess we'll be back to bring it. Moreover, in the beginning, when Moses came to Pharaoh, he never said, let my people go to the land of Israel, right? What he said is, let us go for 3 days to worship in the desert and we will come back. Or later he says, and then we will see. And then he just says, let my people go. And then he's not lying. And then he's saying, just let my people go. You don't get to keep us anymore. But for those Israelites that heard the early reports and then didn't hear the later reports, they must also be somewhat confused. So are we going? Or are we going and coming back? Was going and coming back worth all the hassle of the plagues? What is God playing with? There's a lot of confusion, a lot of justified confusion here. To the point that the rabbis and the commentators throughout the ages pick over the verses that describe the actual coming out and find all kinds of reasons for alarm, all kinds of indications that the will of the people isn't really clear to themselves at this point. Let's look at these indications together and see them in the text itself. I'm going to read slowly this passage again from Exodus 13, 17, 18, that describes the moment of leaving. Now, when Paro let the people go. In Hebrew, it doesn't say now, it says vayehi. And so it was. And the rabbis, all the rabbis, immediately jump in alarm because the word vayehi appears in the Hebrew Bible in moments when it precedes something that's worthy of lament, because it echoes the word nehi, the word for crying, for lamenting. So, for example, if you think about, you know, this week is Purim, and we will read the word yehi. Pay attention that when you read the Megillah, when the word vayehi appears, what kind of event it precedes. You will see that it's events that are alarming or heavy with apprehension. Yet it seems like the totally wrong word here. Here we're talking about finally they were let out of Egypt. So why do you bring this word of lament? What does the word of lament do here? So let's hold that in our mind and keep reading. God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, although it was near. For God said, the people may have a change of heart when they see war and return to Egypt. So what do we know from that? We know already that God is not convinced that the people will stick it out, which means that the people are not convinced, that the people are in such a state of underdetermined will that if they see warfare, if they go through the lands of the Philistines basically worked for the Egyptians at the time, and they were, if I didn't bring a map, but it's they were on the coastal plain coming from Egypt all the way into the land of Israel. So this would have been the quickest way. But he worries that the Philistines are going to try and stop them. The Jews are going to be startled and turn back. And in her book, The Particulars of Rapture, Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg writes the following. For what purpose are we told of the road not taken? Rashi explains, the logic of God's thinking is about the people's desire to return to Egypt. God leads them by a crooked route, hoping that the complication will prevent their having such subversive thoughts. what it tells us is that they have subversive thoughts. They're not walking out of Egypt with glory and song of praise in their heart. They're walking with confusion, with uncertainty. The Israelites, even at this moment, are ambivalent about the movement to freedom. God, he cannot prevent them from thinking thoughts. He can make it harder for them to act on them. By the way, just a side comment about freedom. It's a very interesting moment when God says, okay, I can't control your minds. Your minds are free, but I can make it hard for you to act on it. And a lot of people who struggle with addiction report to doing something similar, to basically creating the habit of delaying the satisfaction in the hope that the higher brain, the higher self will intervene in the interim and remind you of what you actually believe. And let's say I'm dieting and I really like chocolate. So I've developed the habit of whenever I feel like having chocolate, I'm like, okay, I have a 10-minute countdown before I can gratify it. Within those 10 minutes, I hope that the part of me that knows that actually I really don't want to eat the chocolate, I just feel like it, might kick in. So God is almost giving them the tools to wean themselves from the desire to go back to Egypt. There's a little bit of a God as a therapist or as a liberator of the urge, in a sense. But that is an aside comment. Because this is not the only disturbing fact. It's not the only the fact that God takes them the wrong way that indicates there's something wrong. The next indication is in the next verse. So God led the people round about by way of the wilderness of the Sea of Reeds. Now the Israelites went up armed out of the land of Egypt, chamushim. Except Rashi says, no. Chamushim may be the simple word here, but it doesn't fit. And what it actually means is something different. And here I am in the Rashi. The word chamushim means provided with weapons. Another explanation of chamushim is only one out of five went forth from Egypt. And four parts of the people died during the 3 days of darkness because they were unworthy of being delivered. This is a very strong interpretive tradition. We have many midrashim about that, that when God brings the Jews out of Egypt, many people don't want to go. Some stay behind. Some preemptively are killed by God. So imagine now the psyche of the people who survived it and are going out and they watch their families die. And they're scared that God may kill them as he killed the Egyptians. And they're going. And maybe they're going just because of that, because of their fear of God, not because they want to. And every word almost, in every description, we hear the little cracks in the story that turn it from a story of a glorious procession of people freed to the somewhat conflicted and ambivalent march of people who are still very much unconfident about what they want. And this can't do. This is not good enough. The reason is not good enough is not specified to us in the text. We're not told, oh, God said it's not good that they feel this way because we're told that they might go back to Egypt. But if we take a step back and compare it to other historical moments in the history of the world, we might gain a little bit of an insight into why God can't let this uncertainty stand. And I, just as before, I brought examples from American history. I want to jump once again to the history of the American Revolution. I know that you are placed in loyalist Canada, most of you, so please forgive me. I'm joking. But I want to go and visit the mind of one of the great thinkers of the Revolution, John Adams from Boston. John Adams was not the most dashing of the revolutionary founding brothers. He was definitely not the most charming of them, as people in his time made fun of him for incessantly, namely Jefferson. But he was one of the deepest thinkers involved in that process. And he spent the first year of the Continental Congress, as the people in the colonies were trying to decide if they want to rebel, they don't want to rebel, they want to secede from the empire, they don't want to secede from the empire, trying to convince his fellow people in the Continental Congress that going back to Britain, it was impossible, a lost cause. There are many moderates, even in the Congress, who try to say, no, 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 it's all a misunderstanding, all this fixation with that representation. It's corrupted lords, corrupted, people in the government are doing it. But the king represents pure Britain, pure England. The king doesn't know. If we get a hold of the king and tell him what his ministers are doing to us, how they tax us in unfair ways and limit us and commit atrocities, then he will re-embrace us into the British Empire, blah, blah, blah. And he kept saying, no, 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 it's too late. And then in late 1775, King George won the argument for Adams by saying that by passing the Prohibitory Act, declaring the colonies to be in a state of rebellion. Basically finishing the argument, because now at this point, no moderate faction can argue anymore that it's at all possible to rejoin England. Not now when the king himself declares you rebels to his kingdom. You would think that at this point, John Adams would dance a little tap dance on top of the, table or something and rejoicing. Instead, he was extremely disturbed. And in his personal correspondence, he expressed grave concerns, saying we needed more time. People were not ready to throw their lot against England yet. Not enough people in the Congress and in the colonies that sent their representatives to the colonies came to see the world as we do. And now we're going to have to fight a war because King George has just made it impossible to avoid that. And people will need to fight in that war and die in this war and watch their family members die in that war and lose their livelihood in that war for years. And they will not have the backbone to carry it through because they're not convinced yet, because they're doing it because they're forced to it, not because they want it. And he threw himself even more so into trying and convincing people. And sometime later, he was a bit more optimistic. And he wrote the following letter. I am jumping ahead to, just a moment, to box five. And he wrote to James Warren the following in April 1776. They are advancing, but by slow but sure steps to that mighty revolution which you and I have expected for some time, since they were for it from the start. Forced attempts to accelerate their motions, the motion of the members of the Congress, would have been attended with discontent and perhaps convulsions. The royal proclamation and the late act of Parliament have convinced the doubting and confirmed their timorous wavering. I think it is now the precise point in time for our council and House of Representatives either to proceed to make such alterations in our constitution as they may judge proper or to set a petition to Philadelphia for the consent of Congress to do it. At this point, he moves to suggesting that the colonies should adopt new laws, new constitutions of free states and not of colonies. And he goes, I'm jumping a little bit ahead, and he says, 4 months ago, or indeed at any time since you assumed a government, it might have been disagreeable and perhaps dangerous, but it is quite otherwise now. In other words, John Adams has the wisdom to recognize that before you can do the official revolution, before you can fight the war, before you can change the law, the people have to be there in their own conviction. Not dragged along kicking and screaming by the mad King George making his proclamations from London. In many ways, it's almost as if when Moses and God are looking at the people marching out of Egypt, they are thinking the same thing. These people are supposed to somehow withstand all the challenges ahead of them. These are the people that are supposed to go and become God's partners in Mount Sinai, accept a contract with God, cross the Jordan River, fight a whole slew of wars, and build a new society. How are they going to do it? They don't have the internal backbone for it. They don't have the heart for it. they're going to break at the first sight of danger. You can't even take them the straight way because they're going to break at the first sight of danger. And indeed, as soon as the Israelites see the Egyptians chasing them, they, in a sense, affirm exactly this kind of concern, this John Adams-like concern. Let's see it in the text. Moment. Here. Sorry. I'm in box three. As Parah drew near, the Israelites caught sight of the Egyptians advancing upon them. Greatly frightened, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, "Was it for want of graves in Egypt that you brought us to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, taking us out of Egypt? Is this not the very thing we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us be, and we will serve the Egyptians, for it is better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness'?" Exactly as John Adams feared his peers would respond, when they reach money time, if that is how you say that, the Israelites don't have the courage to carry forth. They're not ready. They don't have it within them, despite the fact they killed the gods of Egypt. They do not have it within them to keep walking through the difficulties ahead. And this is where the crossing of the sea becomes crucial, because the crossing of the sea forces them to make a choice. It forces them not to simply be dragged on, but rather to take initiative and forge ahead out of their own volition. And we see that in what follows after their complaint. Immediately after their complaint, Moses treats it as yet another difficulty for God to overcome. I'm here in box six. But Moses said to the people, "Have no fear, stand by and witness the deliverance which the Lord will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will battle for you. You hold your peace." Atenta chavishim, be quiet. In other words, he's saying to them, "I'm going to give you more of the same. Just as God did all the other plagues, God is going to do another plague and you will see and everything will be good." And God says no. God says, "This is not good enough. This is time for a sea change," pun intended. "This is time not to just continue the same story of I do and you ambivalently get dragged along. No, now you make a choice." Here is what God says in Exodus 14. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry out to me? Tell the Israelites to go forward, and you lift up your rod and hold out your arm over the sea and split it so that the Israelites may march into the sea or dry land. And I will stiffen the hearts of the Egyptians so they go in after them, and I will gain glory through Paro and all his warriors, his chariots and his horsemen. Let the Egyptians know that I am Lord when I gain glory through Paro, his chariots and his horsemen.'" I will do a lot, God says, but the beginning is yours. Tell the Israelites to go forward. Don't talk to me. Don't yell to me, Moses, telling me what I need to do. Tell them to go. And then the deliverance and the liberation will come. But they have to jump in. Last week, we discussed the power of fear in enslaving people, and how part of the power or part of the drama of slaying the lambs and placing their blood on the doors was in liberating each individual family, liberating itself from fear as a primary motive. Before they could come out of Egypt, they had to liberate themselves from this existential, deep, slavish fear of the overlord's wrath. In a sense, God is asking them to make the same choice. Here too, not only are they asked to take initiative, they're asked to be willing to embrace the possibility of death. What they tell Moses when they complain, I'm recalling what we read a few minutes ago, is it would have been better for us to be dead in Egypt than dead here. And what God is telling them, throw yourself into the ocean. Make the choice of taking a risk, and you will see that it pays off, that you don't need to be dead in Egypt or here. You can live and be well and free on the other side of the sea. But you can't do that without embracing the possibility of death, without saying, in other words, that there is something that's more important, that's more valuable than survival itself. And this is the moment. This is the moment when they throw themselves in and transform themselves and become initiative takers and gain for themselves the kind of dramatic liberation that then allows them to look back at everything that preceded it and see the fullness, see what they can't see in the middle of the march. So this is another answer to the question why the rabbis and historians and American rebels keep emphasizing the parting of the sea. But before we round it all up together, I want to discuss another element, another layer of another way in which the Exodus can't be complete without the parting of the sea. And this is an element that Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen Milublin, a big Hasidish thinker from the 1700s, speaks about when he reads these psukim back in box two, the pasuk, the verse that we already read before, now and for all let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines. Rabbi Tzadok asks, like other rabbis, as we mentioned before, why is this glorious proclamation of liberty preceded by the word vayehi, a word that traditionally means lament, the term that means, implies lament, lamentation of some sort. And he says that the answer, before you start talking about how God did not lead them by way of the Philistines, how only a fifth of them came out of Egypt, the answer actually lies in the very next words in the verse in Hebrew. Vayehi b'shalach paro. Now, when paro let the people go. At this moment in history, who is the motivating power behind their liberation? Paro. It's not them. They didn't choose to come up and go. In their perception, it's not even God. God may have arranged the historical arena to make it so. But they leave because Paro told them to. So they may be coming out of Egypt, but they're still coming out of Egypt as Paro's subjects. When we understand that, the whole comment, the next comment, about how they should not go through the land of the Philistines receives another historiographical meaning. Who were the Philistines at this point? They were these nations that came from the sea and settled in the coastal plains. But we know that at this point, they were basically a group of vassal tribes to Paro. They were Paro's men. They were Paro's soldiers. They were people who had to offer taxation to Paro and served as some sort of a garrison going up north for Paro's army. So it's not just that they shouldn't go in that direction, that the Israelites shouldn't go in that direction because they will see the Philistines and be scared and spooked and go back. If they go in that direction, they remain in the domain of Paro's power. Historically, there are many people who, by the grace of and favor and request of a king, went to colonize some distant part of the empire, to extend the reach of the empire. I'm not going to go back to the American colonies here, but it's true there too. And if the Israelites would have left because Paro told them to, then traveled under the watchful eyes of Paro's garrison, and then settled just a little bit past the end of the reach of that garrison, for all intents and purposes, from a geopolitical perspective, it would have looked exactly like a colonizing enterprise taken under the orders of an emperor. This is not a new world order. This is not the Israelites leaving behind Egypt and everything it represents with all its ugliness that we discussed already many times in this course. This is them just being an extension of the king's will. And this, says Rabbi Tzadok Milblin, is why the word vayehi, with its connotations of nehi, of lament, appears. Because it's utterly sad that even after everything that happened, on some deep level, the people are still enslaved, are still following the will of the Pharaoh. And their liberation and the project of founding a new way of life can't be complete until there is a incontrovertible, visible, complete and utter cutting away from Pharaoh's will. And this is why we need to have Pharaoh chase them, and we need them to make the choice when seeing him and understanding that he wants to take them back to leave anyway, and to see him and his might drown in the ocean. There is a pasuk in Shirat Hayam, in the song that they sing after seeing it. There's a verse that says, "Sus v'ruchvo tava bayam," a horse and its rider drowned in the sea. And the rabbis say that this is actually symbolic. It's not just that the actual horses and riders drowned, which they did, the Egyptian ones. It's also that the entire system of Egypt that's built on a hierarchy, on a horse and its rider and its rider and its rider all the way to Pharaoh, drowns in the sea. This whole worldview drowns in the sea. And it is only then that you can really start and create something new. One moment. And I'm jumping once again to the American Revolution. It's just a lot of very helpful examples here. And I want to read two different quotes. One is from James Madison, writing in 1792. "In Europe," writes Madison, "charters of liberty had been granted by power. America has set the example, and France has followed it, of charters of power granted by liberty." In other words, for the founders of the American, of the United States of America, they didn't want to be yet another England. They wanted to create an utterly different kind of regime. They wanted to create a world that's built on different terms, not on terms of the will of an emperor, even tempered by rule of law, as it was in the English Empire, British Empire, but rather on the rights of the common men who become shareholders in the government itself. And this creates an entirely different worldview. As George Washington famously wrote in a letter to the Jewish congregation, the Hebrew congregation in Newport, Rhode Island. I'm here in box 5. "It is now," writes Washington, "no more than that toleration I've spoken of. Until now, and historically, people spoke of tolerating the Jews, making laws for tolerating the Jews, tolerating the Catholics, tolerating the Protestants, whoever is a minority group. Let's make some laws that protect them and tolerate them. As if it were the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoyed the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens in giving in it on all occasions their effectual support." You can argue about how accurate Washington is in describing the United States of his time, just as you can argue whether the Declaration of Independence about all men are created equal actually captured lived experience in the colonies at the time or since then. But the sentiment he presents, I think, is hard to argue with. Namely, that in a democracy, in a real democracy where all the citizens are shareholders in the government, you do not speak anymore of protecting the Jewish rights as an act of tolerating them, but rather as being equal in our rights all around. I'm bringing it not to sell. It's not the 4th of July, and I'm not an American at all, actually. But I'm bringing it because I think it illuminates the glory of that moment by the Red Sea. Because in that moment by the Red Sea, what the Israelites are seeing, when they're seeing the entire system of Pharaoh collapse, when they realize that from now on they travel not under Pharaoh's auspices, but through their own and God's initiative and under God's and Moshe's leadership, which they chose to follow now, that moment is the moment when they're not continuing more of the same. They're not following in the footsteps of what came before them. They are ready to start a new type of world, to start a new type of system. And that is yet one more way in which the Red Sea is essential as a completion of the revolution that starts when Paro says, fine, leave, just get out as soon as you can, 7 days earlier. On that note, I will answer some questions, and I have another point that I want to make, but I'll get to it. But I'll take some of your questions from the chat. Moment. Whose avatar is named iPad says, the Red Sea represents rebirth, like the birth canal. The Egyptians destroyed also is closure. They are no longer a threat. Both very good insights. Indeed, the word Mitzrayim means the narrow places. There's a lot of imagery of birth involved. And in many ways, we talked about it when we talked about Moses in the second class of this course. We talked about how Moses' life is almost like a trailer or encapsulating for what happens later. So just as in his case, birth was double, there was the birth at home that his mother gave birth in, but then there was the second birth when he was placed in the river and taken out of the river by the Egyptian princess and adopted by her. Both events completing his birth as a viable baby in the Egyptian world. In a sense, we're seeing something similar happening here, that the birth of the Jewish people as such starts when they leave Egypt, but they need the second birth of being placed in water and out of water to come free on the other side.
And to build on what you said, it's the cutting off is like almost like an umbilical cord, if anybody doesn't mind my saying that.
Yeah, very true.
They're getting through.
Mm-hmm. Seeing the Egyptians drown, seeing the Egyptians, it's just like, okay, now we're really separate. Exactly. Just a moment. Suri Rudolph, to emphasize the point of how we're living in a time of undetermined historical narrative when we're in the middle of things, brought yesterday's New York Times front page headline, how far will Putin go? West is left guessing. Indeed, all of us. Moment. Faye Niederhofer, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, wrote, it must have been very chaotic when the Red Sea parted, as you said, a physical separation and experiencing of being chased. This was very emotional, making the finishing line. Indeed. Just a moment. Gershon Hefner wrote Vayehi, implying that Paro liberated the Israelites, foreshadows the Vayehi that commences the Megillah, which ostensibly implies that the events in it were controlled by Ahasuerus. It is, of course, an untrue about him as about Paro. You say, do I understand correctly, Gershon, that you're saying that there's a certain wink here almost, that when we're told that kings, human kings, are controlling us, it's really kind of not true? Do you mind elaborating?
I'm saying that the author of the Megillah is echoing the narrative in B'Shalach. Just as Pharaoh wasn't the liberator of Israel, so Ahasuerus was not the Israelite liberator of the Judeans in Shushan.
I agree. And yet in both of those cases, I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No.
So in both of those cases, I think the fact that at least on the face of it, it's a human king who moves history is significant. The rabbis in Masechet Megillah say that the Geulah, the salvation of Purim, is incomplete. And they say we can't say Hallel on Purim, according to that opinion, because we're still the slaves of Achashverosh. And in the same way, I think that in that moment when we left Egypt but didn't watch Paro drown yet, we're still the slaves of Paro.
That's very beautiful. That explains Akate Abde Achashverosh. That's beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you for your comment, Gershon. A moment. Deborah said, it is interesting that water continues to play an important role in the Exodus and 40 years journey through the wilderness. So we will discuss that again next week, because next week we're going to talk about several moments of great thirst in the weeks following coming out of Egypt. But I will just say that, as we mentioned before, I think in previous classes, water is also a symbol of life and also a symbol of Torah, of guidance, of a sense of purpose. And also I think of, natural barriers, kind of like Martin Luther King says, it's a natural barrier. There's a natural barrier that the sea now blocks the way. And we will see how in different times water comes to mean different things.
Rachel, I want to tell you something. The Aaron Kotler in his Dvar Torah before yours pointed out that the chapter 6 in Megillah reverses the sadness in the first chapters. Do you understand what I'm saying? All the and the pun that I made when I heard that is that after chapter 6, Haman is deep sixed. You know the phrase, to deep sixth. Yes? So, and that is in fact what Kriyat Yamsuf does to Pharaoh. It deep sixes him, just like the second sixth chapter after chapter 6 of the Megillah.
Thank you. Thank you, Gershon. I appreciate the comment. And it's important that God, when he talks about Kriyat Yamsuf, by the way, I do want to make a comment of that, doesn't just talk about helping the Jews birth themselves. He also says, and now the Egyptians will know. The Egyptians will see the collapse of their power structure. We don't have time to take more questions. I saw some very good questions. I'm sorry. But I do want to say something that's very important to me to put it all together before we finalize today's class. So I apologize in advance if I missed your question. Oh, not in advance. I apologize now if I missed your question. So sorry. And I want to say the following. There's this tendency when you look at great historical events in retrospect, and I mean long retrospect, yes, to glorify them, to look for that moment of explosive joy and liberation where everything is set in place and history ends, right? The story ends. And this tells us one very important thing. It tells us something about our psyche, that our psyche wants closed stories. Our psyche wants that satisfaction that comes from having a beginning and a middle and an end. And we can close the book and say, ah, this was wonderful, right? But that's not life. That's our way of making sense of the world we live in, of encoding values and passing them on to our children, of encoding warnings and passing them on to our children, of creating a joint, a shared mythology of society that can enable us to live together. We need storytelling, but it's important not to be trapped by storytelling. And when we look at, say, the American Revolution, if you're American, or the French Revolution in some cases, or the foundation of the State of Israel, or with more relevance to our discussion, the Exodus, there's this tendency to look for the major key event that seals the deal. And as we will see next week, that doesn't happen. There are major key events. There's no question that the parting of the sea that invites the people to show initiative, that finally takes us from under the grace of Paro into our own story, that visually shows us what the story means and what the direction is. There's no question that this is a major key event. We know that because then they look at it and sing. They put it into a narrative form themselves. They express it as a story. For them, it feels like an ending also. But it's also just the beginning of their journey towards peoplehood. They are born as a people in the sense that they're done with a Paro stage of their life. But as we know from actual till birth, when a baby is born, just because the umbilical cord is cut, that baby is nowhere near ready to start walking and running their own lives. That would make life very different. And according to some Midrashic tradition, this reality, the reality that even after the major key events, there's a lot of work to be done and history is never really fully over. The story can't just be closed and set aside. According to some Midrashic events, this reality was created in response to the sin of Adam and Eve. But until then, the world was supposed to be just perfect as it is. Babies would have been born as adults. The earth would just give its fruit. And then by proving their humanity, proving that they are not perfect themselves, they prove that the world cannot be perfect for them. Whether you choose to hold by this Midrashic tradition or not, it's a warning to carry with us as we turn the page and look at the next moment. Because next week we will discuss what can be called the childhood or the adolescence of the Jewish people before they make it to Sinai. And then we will discuss the sins that follow Sinai. And then there's going to be 40 years in the desert. And then there's going to be exiles and failures and all sorts of things piling one over the other. But just as we shouldn't allow ourselves to be deluded by the major key moments and thinking that the story is over, that the journey for freedom can be set aside because it's complete, it's also important not to err on the other end and ignore those moments, be cynical and ignore these moments as the moments, as the important moments they are, because, oh, but that wasn't the end of the road, as we will see. Now they're going to start complaining about things, et cetera, et cetera. It's still worthy to stop and to sing, because it's in that song that we bring our own human ability to recognize grace, to recognize God, to recognize greatness into fruition. So I wish for all of us that we will have many opportunities to sing in the coming days and in the coming weeks. May we see good things happen. May we see an end to suffering. May we see the rise of justice. And may we be attuned enough to recognize it in song. And on that note, I'm wishing you all Purim Sameach.
Amen. May we have Purim Sameach.
Thank you. You too.
Menach Focho.
Menach Focho.
Beautiful.
Well, everyone, okay.